This recording is from Christ Kingdom Church in Waterford Lakes, East Orlando. Visit us online at christkingdom.org for our calendar, driving directions, and more audio recordings.
Well, good morning. That was not very convincing. Good morning. Oh, yeah, I'm feeling it now. Thank you. Hey, well, welcome again to Christ Kingdom Church. Again, if you're new here or have missed in recent weeks, I just want to remind you of some tools that we have that are available to you that go along with our sermon series called Share the Story this year. One is this notebook. This is just a binder that those, if you notice your sermon inserts, have are three-ring hole punched this year. These are free. They're back there just if it makes it available, easy for you to collect this. There's also blank sheet of paper in here that you can take journal, you know, use it for other reasons or a prayer request list. That's completely free. But we also have this resource. There's not many of these left. I'm excited that you guys have been buying these up pretty quick. These are only $5. You can't, that was a special deal we got. We're passing on to you. You really can't get it anywhere close to that price anymore. So if you're thinking about getting one, please grab one. We are following chapter by chapter as we go along through, and I believe it's chapter 3 that we're looking at here as we pull out the character of Judah this morning. And we're just encouraging you to read along with your family, by yourself, with your small group or some friends or over coffee. Follow with the story as we pull out a different character each week as we go through this. It'll be a valuable resource that you might want to take advantage of and be a part of. Well, 2 weeks ago, the very first character we looked at from chapter 1 was the serpent that you might recall from that. You might remember this picture here, which some of you do not appreciate as much as others. There's a snake in your story, right, Don? And it's scary. But there, the reality is that we have an enemy. And that enemy is a very real one that shows up in the Garden of Eden, and he's also there in the book of Revelation. So don't you think he's everywhere in between? He is. The second thing we talked about last week was the story of Leah and how Leah came to understand that the blesser is the blessing. So often we're looking for the blessing, and where is it? And God, show up and do this, and then we get something that's a blessing, and it doesn't seem to be all that great, or we need to go on to the next blessing, and we're missing sometimes that the blesser, God himself, is the ultimate blessing that we're looking for. Leah discovers that. And now we continue this week in looking at Judah. We mentioned Judah last week because Judah was the fourth son that she had born, and she named him Praise because things began to change in Leah's heart and understanding as she began to quit looking for acceptance of those around her here on earth and begin to look and make her delight in the God who had created her. So as we look at here this morning, we're using this model pretty much each week, at least we have so far, and I think we'll continue. As we look at a different character each week, we'll look at their story. This week, we're looking at Judah's story. Then we'll come back and we'll see, how does that have bearing or implications to your story? One of the things that I mentioned last week, and I want to just remind you that the primary reason why we have character stories in the Bible is not so you'll think, oh, I should be like Judah. No, the primary reason is for you to understand that Judah is a mess, just like me and you. Judah needed a real God to show up on the scene, and God did. And just like you're a mess like Judah, he's going to show up on the scene of your heart and life if you want him to, if you invite him to, if you look for him to. And even sometimes when you don't, hallelujah, he's going to show up. That is some of our the truths here that we have to look at here this morning. And then lastly, we're going to look at how every part, every story of the Old Testament either specifically will touch on pointing to the Messiah or is ultimately fulfilled in the coming of the Messiah, Jesus Christ. So we're looking at Judah's story this morning, your story, and then his story. Well, like the rest of his ancestors, as I already mentioned, Judah was a mess. If you remember last week, we talked about, we went all the way back to Abraham and talked about how different things were going on. The family could have been a modern-day sitcom. It could have been a soap opera for the things that happened. And if you think it's going to get any less messier with Judah, well, buckle up. It's not. If anything, it may get worse as we look forward here, what happens here. So let's take a look. Let's start and dive in right in. If you have your outline, if you want to follow along there. Now we're going to look at Judah's story here first. We're going to take some observations because I think there's at least three key observations that we can learn from his story. We read just part of his story here because it covers and spans chapters. It would take way too long for us to read. But I kind of kind of like Paul Harvey used to do. You know, he would tell you this, you know, some conclusion or something you know, and he would say, let me tell you the rest of the story. Well, I'm going to tell you the rest of the story. You saw the example here of where Judah here was coming and being reunited with the family and with Joseph and so on. But let's look at his full story. Because the first thing I want you to realize, the first observation I want you to see this morning is that the first wrong that wasn't right. I want you to see the first wrong that wasn't right. You see, like each of us, Judah is made for a world of rightness. I like what Larry Crabb said, and I think his book, I think it was Inside Out, I read years ago. We are not designed by God to live in a sinful world. So can't you imagine when you live in a sinful world and experience it, things just seem broken? Can you imagine why you have emotional, psychological struggles and difficulties? Because you weren't wired to be functioning in a world where sin reigns. And yet it does. Some have said life wouldn't be so hard if we didn't expect it to be so easy. Life is hard. Life is story, and story is life. And as we look here, we unpackage it here with Judah. Judah is born, and like every other child, he longs for love and acceptance, not just from his mother, but probably especially boys. Don't they long for love and acceptance from their father? There's something about that bond, right, between a father and a son. He's looking for those words that say, son, I'm proud of you. Attaboy, you're my boy. Every child longs to hear that their father takes delight in them. But again, Judah entered into a broken world. He entered into a wrong world as he was born. As quickly as his mom was calling him and naming him, praise for the delight that he represented for her and her heart's affection moving from looking for her approval from Jacob to finding it in God, it didn't take long before Judah realized that something wasn't quite right. See, his father doesn't love and accept him the way he wants and the way he needs. And even more so, he doesn't love and accept him like he does his son Joseph. Now, most of us, if you've spent any time as a child in church, you got the story of Joseph, right? He's the guy that had the multicolored jacket, all right? He looked good on it. And let me tell you, all his older siblings and siblings from the other mother, Leah, they got nothing. I mean, for Pete's sake, there's a Broadway play about Joseph, right? And the technicolor jacket. Judah's got nothing yet on Broadway. And Judah had nothing at that point. It doesn't take long for siblings to realize if one is favored over another. And how long do you think it took Judah to see a younger sibling being favored over him? Jacob does not delight in him, at least not like Joseph. Joseph has this colorful jacket as proof and show of it. You know, sometimes kids speculate, you know, is it there? But here is crystal clear evidence. And don't you know, Joseph was sporting it every day, walking around with it. Judah responds embittered. As you can imagine, it would be so easy for any kid to do. He would have agreed with Martin Luther King Jr., who said, a right delayed is a right denied. Judah knew something. Something was hardwired in him to know that it's not right for a father to give preferential treatment to another sibling. And in such even a clear and obnoxious way of doing it, the way he chose to. He does next what each of us do when we discover the world isn't right. When we conclude that we can't rely on the world to make things right, because it was a rude awakening to Judah, but he learned it really quick. And it led to the second observation. The second wrong that wasn't right. The first one that wrong that wasn't right was that it's a wrong world that you live in. Just like every kid early on learns the phrase, that's not fair, right? We don't use it as adults. We clean it up. We make it more complicated. We make it a paragraph, but we say the same thing as adults. The second observation is that wasn't, the second wrong that wasn't right was something that Judah encountered personally. It was the wrong that was not external, but the wrong that was internal. Judah had a wrong heart. He had a wrong heart. Let's dive more into that in his story. Judah seeks to make his world right on his own. And that's where we begin to get glimpses into what was going on in his heart. As I mentioned, Judah's growing up. He's got this brother Joseph. He's getting all the special treatment, all the special favor, all the delight of his father. And Judah's getting nothing, just like the rest of his brothers there. And so Judah comes up with a fantastic idea. And kids, if you're listening and following along with this story, here's a Bible story that you might want to remember. Now, you got to hear the whole story, but listen to Judah's fantastic idea. And let me read from chapter 37, verses 23 through 28. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they were out in the wilderness, away from home, they stripped him of his robe, the ornate robe he was wearing, and they took him and threw him into the cistern. The cistern was empty. There was no water in it. And they sat down to eat their meal. They looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead, their camels loaded with spices, balm, and myrrh, and they were on their way to take them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, so it's Judah's idea, right? Judah says to his brothers, what will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? See, he's reasonable. Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he is our brother, our own flesh and blood. His brothers agreed. So when the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph up out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites, who took him to Egypt. That's a brilliant plan. Kids, nod your head if you think that's a brilliant plan. You ever thought about, you know, what if we just made a little cash on the side and got rid of little sissy, big brother? Judah thought it was brilliant. Judah thought, I'm going to get rid of the competition, and I'm also going to have a chance to take a shot at my dad. Don't you think that was somewhere in that? Somewhere along the way, he probably knew he was never going to win his father's affection, but he could take his dad down with him. If that's what dad prizes way above me and my other brothers, it'd be nice to see him feel like how I feel. He had to be feeling something like that. Rather than pull his father's affections, though, towards him, because he probably had some hope that maybe, if Joseph's out of the picture, maybe dad will give some of that love back to the rest of us. Maybe I'll get some. Maybe I'll get 1/12 or so. But rather than pulling his father's affection anyway back towards them, it gets just the opposite. Jacob's response is, might as well kill me. It's like he mourns, he grieves, he goes through this whole thing as if he has no other sons at all. Judah probably thinks here, there is no hope. If I got rid of the competition, got back at dad a little bit, thought it might bring him back to me, it's not even doing that. So this is the last straw for Judah. You know what he does next? He packs up and he runs away. He leaves home to escape his father and family. Why? Because they're the greatest reminders of the wrongness of this world. Get rid of that. Get that out. He wants that in the rearview mirror as he's leaving town. Judah is on his own search now for rightness. On his own. He finds a wife, it says, on his own. He has three sons on his own. Now, this may not seem so weird to us here today, but it was weird back then. Families stuck and hung in together. You lived together. You sometimes shared the same roof. Judah's flying solo. He's going to parent, don't you know? Don't you know somewhere in his mind he's going to parent different than his father parented him? But where Jacob neglected and devalued him and his brothers, Judah's response, we can tell from the context in the text, is probably just the opposite. He probably overindulges his sons. Rather than getting zero attention or affection that he got, he comes and goes the other extreme, which, by the way, is a very common thing that we do even today, isn't it? I'll explain to you more why I think that's what happened there, even though the text doesn't say that explicitly. But listen to this. This is important. What his sons needed was not overindulgence, just like overindulgence is not what Judah lacked. Both Judah and now his sons miss one of the most valuable things a parent can teach their child. And it's this: what is the source of rightness? Judah knew it wasn't to be found in the world. But Judah was needing to discover now it wasn't going to be found in him either. Him taking charge, him making it happen, wasn't going to do it either. We're told from the text that his sons are wicked in God's sight. In fact, they're so wicked, the first one who's born named who gets married to a woman named Tamar, the text says that God struck him down because he was wicked. Now, God doesn't strike people down in the Bible very often because they're wicked. But here's one of the few examples, just right off the bat. The story goes on from this, and it gets a little bit messier, as you might know, some of you that know it. The second son that he had was named Onan. Onan is wicked also, we're told. See, the custom at the time was if your sibling died and left a wife who was a widow and they had no children, the custom was for that other brother, the next oldest brother, to come and to produce offspring in his brother's name. Following with me? So that was his duty. That was his responsibility. Judah knows this. In fact, Judah tells him to do it because it's the right thing to do. And Judah is all about rightness. Genesis 38:8 says this, "Then Judah said to Onan, 'Sleep with your brother's wife and fulfill your duty to her as a brother-in-law to raise up offspring for your brother.'" He tells him to do it because he knows it's the right thing to do. The only problem is that Onan, again, was wicked. Onan knew that if he did that, well, these children or this child would not be considered his. It would be considered his brother's. What gain would he have from it? Well, none. But he could have fun in the process. It's a messy story. It's not a very Sunday morning story, is it? We're told that Onan did spend time with his brother's wife, but made sure she didn't get pregnant. You tracking with me, folks? This is about as deep as I want to go on that storyline. All the fun, none of the responsibility. Onan was wicked. And God struck him down. See, Onan treated Tamar like a prostitute. She was simply providing a service for him. But on the other hand, he didn't provide anything back for her. God saw this as wicked, and he struck him down. Well, Judah had a third son. His name was Shelah. And he was apparently too young to marry at that particular time. But we're told that Judah sends Tamar away to live with her father. He pretty much is trying to get her out of the picture. Listen to what the text says in verse 11. "Judah then said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, 'Live as a widow in your father's household until my son Shelah grows up.' For he thought, 'He may die too, just like his brothers.' So Tamar went to live in her father's household." He's trying to get rid of her. If strike one, strike two, well, my goodness, we're not going to have a strike three. Judah isn't concerned anymore about rightness for Tamar. Judah is concerned about rightness for him. No father should lose one, two, much less three sons. Time passes, and Tamar realizes that she's been living now with her father and his father's household that Judah has no doubt forgotten. Obviously, Shelah has gotten to the age where he could have married her, and there's no sounds of that even happening. There's no rumors that it's even going to happen at all. Tamar, as you can imagine, is feeling even more rejected and dejected. Tamar, who was treated like a prostitute, ironically, by Onan, decides to pretend to be one to try to right the wrong herself. Now, this story is not about Tamar, but do you see the same pattern here? She's on a search for rightness herself, because she's quickly found out the world around her is quite wrong. Tamar's plan. It's a pretty amazing plan. This is good soap opera stuff. I'm telling you guys, this is they must read their Bibles to get some of these storylines. Tamar's plan, she'll disguise herself as a prostitute. She's felt like one before. She can certainly play the role. She knows that her father, Judah, now, Judah has become a widower at this point. His wife has died. So put yourself in Judah. Life is not very nice and fair and clean and neat and good for Judah at all. Abandoned by his father, emotionally at least, left home, first two sons killed, struck down by God. Now he loses his wife. Judah's not in a good spot. She decides to seduce her father-in-law, who she finds out is going to be traveling nearby at some point. She comes and dresses up like a prostitute with her face disguised or covered so he can't tell who it is. And her whole goal was to seek to gain a rightful offspring that she should have been given through Shelah, his youngest son, to get that through him. Tracking with me, everybody? This is the story. It's quite messy. I think you'd have to agree. Well, Judah takes the bait. And the payment is the promise that he'll provide a goat to her. He doesn't have the goat with him. So she's like, what are you going to give me for a down payment? And she ends up taking his seal, his cord, his staff, basically his driver's license is kind of what she's asking for here. Make sure that he's got to deliver, because he's going to want these things back. And once Judah, after leaving, comes back and they can't end up finding even who she was or that there even was a prostitute, tries to forget about it and goes on with things until he hears the rumor that Tamar is pregnant. His first son's widowed wife has been a prostitute. And he is enraged. Once more, Judah's thinking, I have been wronged. I even tried to help her out. I sent Onan to her. You know he's thinking that, don't you? He's enraged. He cries out for her to be put to death because it would be the right thing to do. If a widowed daughter-in-law became a prostitute. And here's the key point for the morning that you need to remember. Two wrongs need a right. Two wrongs need a right. And let's look at a third observation as we unpack it set more. The right that conquers wrong. The right that conquers wrong. The story is not over yet. Judah encounters that in this story with Tamar. Let me read from chapter 38, verses 25 through 26. As she was being brought out, by the way, as she was being brought out for execution, get the context. As she was being brought out, she sent a message to her father-in-law. I am pregnant by the man who owns these, she said. And she added, see if you recognize whose seal, whose cord, and whose staff these are. Verse 26, Judah recognized them and said, quote, she is more righteous than I, since I want to give her to my son Shelah. She is more righteous than I, because I would not give her my son Shelah. You know, like when EPAS or SunPass sends you a picture in the mail that says you owe a toll and here is proof. And that's a hypothetical thing, not that that's ever happened to me. Here's the evidence right in Judah's face. And it's almost, it reminds me so much of how it must have been with David when he was being confronted by Nathan. And David gets enraged through this little story that Nathan says of this great, powerful person who has abused this small little pheasant guy, and David wants him put to death. And Nathan says, you're the man. Judah sees Tamar's righteousness. It exposes his wrongness. Judah thought he's been doing pretty well. He's been on a journey. He's been on a mission. The world was wrong, but he was going to make things right. And unlike Onan, he didn't sleep with her again, the text says after that. Something happened. Something changed. I believe, because the text goes on and tells us amazing things, which I'm about to tell you, that Judah was a different guy after this particular encounter. You know, there's 12 sons of Jacob that are in there, but we only have one story like this that steps out where we get this one whole chapter about Judah and Tamar. Why? Because it's important. Because something happens here that Moses, who is giving the account from Genesis, doesn't want you to miss. God doesn't want you to miss. The story of Tamar is why Judah apparently changed. Judah sees, apparently, that there is a God who is righteous. He's changed from this point going forward. And let me give you some of the reasons why I believe that. Chapter 42 of Genesis goes on just a few chapters later and says, Judah returns home to help during the time of famine. Now you could read right past that and go, well, what's the big deal? You know, it's holiday time maybe. You go home, you know, Your family's in trouble. But think about it. This was a place he couldn't leave fast enough. He could have left his father Jacob to fend for himself and rightly justified it and said, you know, Dad, you've been nothing to me. You're not going to get any help from me, even though the whole area is in famine. Don't you think it would have been a little bit easier for Judah to try to feed himself and the small family that he had than try to be part of the bigger family back home with all the miles they had to feed there? It wasn't a logical choice to go back. He's got his own problems. He's a widower. He's lost two sons. He's estranged with his family. But he decides to return home knowing that his family is in crisis. And I have to ask, and I want you to ask why. And my guess is this, is that he, after that transition with Tamar, after his confrontation of his own heart, remembered the stories of his childhood, of his grandfather, Isaac, of his great-grandfather, Abraham. And Abraham, who had been promised to become a nation that would be a blessing to the world, a nation that would bring rightness to the world around them. But the source of rightness was not going to be found here on earth, Judah had to discover. The source of rightness was not going to be found in him. The source of rightness was going to be found in God. Because Abraham, we know, this text tells us, he believed God and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. He trusted God. God was the source of rightness. He didn't need to know, Judah, how it was going to all work out. He just needed to trust God. And he knows it's time to go home. And he goes. Two wrongs need a right. Judah takes responsibility, we're told, for Benjamin. You remember from the story that was, we got a little bit of a glimpse of it that we read here this morning. When they go and they go to Egypt to get food for the famine, and there they encounter Joseph. They don't know it's Joseph. Joseph knows it's them. He gives them lots of food, but he says, look, if you ever need to come back, you ever need to get more, you better bring, in fact, you must bring Benjamin, his other, Joseph's other brother, from his mother, Rachel. Not just anybody. Benjamin had not been part of that trip because Dad wanted to make sure Benjamin stayed just fine at home and nothing happened to him like it happened to Joseph. So we know the problems are still happening at home, by the way. But we're told here in this text that when Judah goes back and they need to get more food for the famine, he tells his father in chapter 43 that he will personally go with Benjamin and take responsibility for him. Do you understand what's going on there? Joseph, who he couldn't get rid of fast enough, who it was his idea to sell into slavery, and then to come back and lie to Dad and say he got killed. Oops, sorry. This is Joseph's younger brother, Benjamin, who is doing the same thing. We're not told he has the colorful coat, but he's getting the preferential treatment nevertheless. For Judah to come and say, look, I will personally, Dad, guarantee his safety. Something has changed big time. The bitterness is evaporating to at least some degree. There is a work happening in Judah's life. Two wrongs need a right. Judah doesn't just stop there, but he goes and he confesses his own deception, we're told. In Genesis chapter 44, verses 27, it says, your servant, my father, said to us, and he's talking to Joseph here now. Again, he doesn't know it's Joseph. He comes out and says, you know that my wife bore me two sons. One of them went away from me, and I said, he surely has been torn to pieces, and I have not seen him since. Here's Judah confessing the very thing he did right to Joseph, even though he doesn't know it's Joseph at the time. Something's changed. He didn't have to offer those details of the story, but there is repentance happening in the life of Judah here. Judah has not only seen his lack of rightness, but he shares it openly now with someone he doesn't even know and has no responsibility to share it to. Joseph didn't need those details. It's an indication that something has happened and that two wrongs do indeed need a right. And it doesn't just stop there. The story gets even better. Judah, as you know from the story, Joseph actually plants silver and stuff in their bags so they can be caught and accused of stealing, even though they haven't. And whose bags do they put them in as they go back? Benjamin's. And of course, Joseph, after they get on the road, goes and has them get caught. And of course, Benjamin is the one. And Benjamin is the one that he's about to threaten to throw into prison. But Judah steps up. Genesis 44, verse 32. Your servant, this is Judah talking to Joseph, your servant guaranteed the boy's safety to my father, I said. If I do not bring him back to you, I will bear the blame before you, my father, all my life. Now then, please let your servant remain here as my lord's slave in place of the boy, and let the boy return with his brothers. How can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? No, do not let me see the misery that would come on my father. Judah, who are you and what have you done with Judah? Aren't you thinking that? Do you see the irony? Judah's all about throwing the spoiled kid in jail when it was Joseph. And here's a spoiled kid, Benjamin, that could easily, Judah could have said, dude, you got caught. Benjamin, I'm sorry, man. We'll see you. We got the food. Take some time in jail. Think about it. He could have so done that. But he comes back and he fights for his father's delight and joy, Benjamin. He tells Joseph, again, he doesn't even know it's Joseph, and he says, look, take me instead. Put me in jail in this place. Are you kidding me? There is a radical transformation in Judah's life. And you thought the story of Joseph was cool? Gosh, we've missed the story of Judah in this whole thing. And he wants to do it to protect his father, Jacob, and so he will not grieve again. What has happened between he and his father? His father doesn't seem very different. Judah, on the other hand, is different. It's interesting from the text, the action of what Judah does there, that exact place that what I just read softens Joseph's heart. Joseph's kind of playing with him. Joseph's got his own bitterness. Joseph's been lost everything that he had, and he's finally got to power here now, and he can wipe him out, and Joseph doesn't know what to do. He's a mess. But right after that story, Joseph's changed. And he tells them to all leave the room, and he weeps. Because he sees Judah's changed. Judah was the one that told him to be thrown into jail. But yet he's going to go and he's going to go in place of Benjamin. Joseph sees the change in Judah and it changes Joseph. Joseph's heart is broken. Joseph's faith, I believe, is rekindled in God's rightness. Two wrongs needed a right. You know what else is also amazing? Judah is given an incredible blessing, apparently years later, by Jacob before he dies. Jacob, on his deathbed, pronounces this over Judah. Let me just read the first couple of verses of it. This is Genesis 49, verse 8. Jacob, his estranged father at one time, the one he wanted to kill or get away from, says this to Judah, Judah, your brothers will praise you. Remember, his name means praise. Your brothers will praise you. Your hand will be on the neck of your enemies. How about on the head of a serpent? Who Jesus will come from one day, Judah. Your father's sons will bow down to you. You are a lion's cub, Judah. You return from the prey, my son. Like a lion, he crouches and lies down. Like a lioness who dares to rouse him. The scepter will not depart from you, Judah. Judah wasn't a king. But there was a king that was going to come through Judah. There is an amazing story going on here. And you thought this story had nothing to do with Jesus? Are you kidding me? It's dripping with it. There's restoration that's apparently happened between Judah and Jacob by the time Jacob's about to die. Perhaps Judah is finally experiencing God's power to make things right in his own perfect way and perfect timing. Two wrongs need a right. But here's my question that he no doubt wrestled with that I want you to wrestle with today is who are you trusting to make things right? Who are you trusting to make things right? Most of us in this room are old enough to say we're not going to trust the world anymore. Because we're like, yeah, I tried that once. But most of us are old enough also to have made this shift from trusting the world to trusting ourselves. That we can somehow make it right. Or at least right for us. or write enough? As you can guess, it's time to talk about your story, my story, and also the first wrong that wasn't right. You entered into a wrong world. I'm sorry, the day you were born, I know you celebrate and you sing happy birthday on the day that you were born, but really in some ways it wasn't so happy because you entered into a sinful world that you weren't made for. Listen to what 1 John 2 says. Do not love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in them. For everything in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life comes not from the Father, but from the world. And the world and its desires are passing away. But whoever does the will of God lives forever. Or if that wasn't obvious enough, listen to Romans 3, verse 10. As it is written, there is no one righteous, no one righteous. Not even one. There's no one who understands. There's no one who seeks God. All have turned away. They have to come together worthless. There's no one who does good, not even one. This world is wrong. And it will never be ultimately right until Jesus returns. Let me tell you this. Every single person here, you know this from home. And even if you grew up with Christian parents, you know it from home. Because you have felt and been the recipient of failures, even from Christian parents. And my goodness, if you had non-Christian parents, there wasn't even the restraint of righteousness there or the teaching of scriptures they were holding to. Probably was worse. But I don't think it was that much better in your Christian home. Because there was still wrongness. There was still brokenness. You were still, every person here, you were wounded by a parent or parents at one time or another and probably multiple times. And hopefully there's been reconciliation. I've had to have times of reconciliation with my kids. And I don't think I'm done. Wish I was. Because I'm a broken father. I'm a broken husband. I'm a mess. But I don't think I'm alone. You know from middle school, if you didn't get it earlier on, I guarantee you got it from middle school. How many of you have been in middle school? How many of you would want to repeat middle school? Oh my gosh, does it get much worse than that? As far as what we as kids, we're ready to start making the world right. Hey, you don't want to be my friend? Well, I'm going to talk to you behind your back. You know, or, hey, you're going to treat me that way? Well, let me get me my couple of my buddies and we'll show you. We'll earn some respect from you. I mean, that kind of junk is going on all over the place. No wonder we got bullying issues. We want things to be done with. Because middle school is where that inward, independent person in us is just ready to bloom, ready to make things right. If you didn't get it in middle school, you definitely got it in high school. Some of you definitely got it in college. You know about it from your adult life. You know clearly that you've entered a wrong world. I love what C.S. Lewis says. He says, if we find ourselves with a desire that nothing in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that we were made for another world. Absolutely. But you're stuck in this world for now. But this world is fading away, is the good news. As soon as you encounter, though, this reality, just like for Judah, as soon as you encounter this reality, you will try to make your world right, just like Judah did, just like I do, just like you will. Two wrongs need a right. And the question is, who are you trusting to make things right? Secondly, the second wrong that wasn't right. You have a wrong heart, just like Judah discovered. Judah thought for a while he was doing pretty well, being pretty right, until it came back and it met him in the face by a young lady who had the courage named Tamar to step out. And not in a typical Sunday school answer way, right? Jeremiah 17:9 says this, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. Who can understand it? Jeremiah is saying, not me, and not you. Mark 7, this is Jesus speaking. If you want to know what's in the human heart, Jesus tells you. From within, out of the heart of man, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. etc. That's what Jesus says comes. Like batteries included, comes included that in the human heart when you're born. If you're old enough, you know you can look back and see how you responded to the wrong. I'm not sure if you did it when you're in elementary school and responded to the world around you. Maybe you did it in middle school. Maybe it happened in high school. But somewhere along the way, you probably began to harden your heart, my guess is. You begin to withdraw. You isolated yourself. You let bitterness grow. You covered the wounds and the shame any way you could. You protected yourself at middle school or joined in belittling others and grew increasingly cynical of rightness. You experiment in high school with independence and exploring new avenues of self-produced rightness. You were freed of parental restraints in college and let your own pursuit of rightness either grow more religious or grow more anti-religious. Both will take you away from the one who's right if you let it. The Pharisee, the pagan, or the follower of Jesus. You will continue to try to right your world until you realize you cannot right your own heart. And when you realize that you are as much part of the problem as the world around you, then you will begin to search for someone that can conquer not only the world, but your heart. Because two wrongs need a right. And who are you trusting to make it right? The right that conquers the wrong is his story. Is his story. Remember, Jesus is the line of Judah. He will be Judah's great, 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 whatever, descendant, grandson. Through Tamar. Jesus is the one who enters our wrong world to make it right. He wasn't himself, by the way, immune to wrongness. Think about Jesus' own life. He didn't come in as the Joseph with a coat of many colors and take charge. He came in like a Judah. Do you realize what kind of mom he was born to? Oh, we know that she was a virgin. But nobody believed that back then. Everybody thought, dude, she's an adulteress. And I've heard lots of excuses for how you get pregnant apart from marriage. But a virgin birth, that's really a first. Joseph, Mary, you guys are very creative. How many people do you think really believe that? I'm not sure Joseph believed it fully. Probably only Mary her entire life. Most of it, by most people. That's the stigma she embraced. That's the stigma Jesus comes into the world. Don't you think that affected his childhood? Don't you think people treated him or looked at him a little bit differently, or there was whispers behind the back when Jesus was around? That bastard son. Herod sought to kill him and wiped out every other boy, baby, 2 years and under in the realm in an attempt to wipe out Jesus. Jesus had to leave him. Jesus had to go live in Egypt with Joseph and Mary for several years. His family, even in his ministry days, were told they come looking for him at one point in the midst of the crowds, and they try to call him out because they think he's mad. How's that, you know, for family support? Mom and my brothers and sisters think I'm mad. They want to take me home. He's abandoned by his followers and friends when he needed them most. Two wrongs need a right. Who are you trusting to make things right? The second wrong isn't a problem for Jesus, which is where the story starts to change, because Jesus has a right heart from birth. Oh, he entered a wrong world, but this is where it's different. He had a right heart. It's a game changer. He's the king of righteousness, the scriptures say. David himself in the Psalms, Psalm 110, a later descendant of Judah, coming before Jesus, says this in Psalm 110, verse 4, "You are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek." Anybody know a kid named Melchizedek? maybe Mel, right? Look at, what is Melchizedek? King of righteousness. This is a prophetic psalm about the Messiah. He's the King of righteousness. 1 John 2:1, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ, the righteous one. That's who goes before us, before God the Father. People were blown away by Jesus' purity of heart. He wasn't partial. Multiple times in the Gospels it says he showed no partiality. He didn't favor anybody. Who's ever lived a life like that? Nobody. He wasn't insecure. He wasn't arrogant. He wasn't trying to impress anybody. He was the Son of God. Two wrongs needed a right. But who are you trusting to make things right? And Jesus is the right that conquers the wrong. He entered our wrong world. He had a right heart. And even the night that Jesus would be betrayed by the world and even by his friends, the night before, or the night that he was crucified, he says this in John 16. This is just hours before all that goes down. A time is coming, and in fact has come, when you will be scattered, each to your own home. You will leave me all alone. Yet I am not alone, for my Father is with me. I have told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble. But take heart. I have overcome the world. It's a story changer. Just like he will overcome the world, you know an even greater foe that he will overcome? Your heart. Because the world's out there. The world's kind of like, yeah, that's them, blah, 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 blah. But you start messing in here? Can Jesus really conquer here? That's kind of out there, it seems removed. Right here is personal. Right here is where the greatest doubts are. Right here is where the greatest fears are. CNN has flashed nothing on its screen that you haven't flashed darker and deeper and more scary in your heart. And I have in my heart. He can conquer your wrong heart. Listen to what Ezekiel 36 says, the prophet prophesying about the Messiah. Moreover, God said through him, I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit within you, and I will remove the heart of stone from your flesh and give you a heart of flesh. 2 Corinthians 5:17, Paul says, Paul, who needed desperately a new heart, after he gets it, says, therefore, if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creature. The old things have passed away. Behold, new things have come. AKA, a new heart. Galatians 4:6, and because you are sons, God has sent the Spirit of his Son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. Those that were slaves to sin has become sons to righteousness, daughters to righteousness through faith in Jesus Christ. Two wrongs need a right. Bottom line, who are you trusting in to make it right? Think about that as we pray. God, would you come and would you remind us of our desperate need, God, to find rightness in the only one place we can. Not in this world, not in ourselves, but in the finished work of Jesus Christ on the cross. His resurrection, his ascension to the right hand of the Father, his promised return. The promise that one day every tear will be wiped away, every pain will be gone. We'll have new bodies to match the new hearts that have been implanted. There'll be a new heavens and a new earth, and the old order will be gone, and the enemy will be cast to the lake of fire. God, we were made for that kind of world, and you're bringing that kind of world. You're bringing your kingdom here on earth as it is in heaven. Would you do that in our hearts this morning in a very specific way? Would you do that in our church for your glory and honor? And God, would you come, and as we come to your table even now, would you remind us that we've been set free from the curse of sin and that everything right is to be found in you, so we can quit trying to produce it and make it happen in us. Gosh, how restful that would be to do that. So bring that kind of rest now. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.